From the studios of Boise State Public Radio, I'm Gemma Gaudette. It's Friday, time for our end-of-year reporter roundtable. This is when we look back at the headlines that made news this entire year of 2022. And today, our panel includes Melissa Davlin, host of Idaho Reports on Idaho Public Television, Clark Corbin with Idaho Capital Sun, James Dawson with Boise State Public Radio News, and Kevin Richard, senior reporter and blogger with Idaho Education News. Hi, everybody.
Hey, Gemma.
Hello. Happy Festivus.
Hi, Gemma.
Hi. Okay. So, Kevin and Jimmy, I want to start with, I think, some of the biggest news headline that happened this year, and it only happened last month in November, and this was up in Moscow, when I think it's fair to say that the entire state was stunned when we found out that four University of Idaho students had been stabbed to death in their home. Kevin and Jimmy, this case has captured the attention of the world. Can you and Jimmy, I'll start with you, kind of set up what we know at this point? And let me clarify to people, we are taping this. So if there is news that comes out after our taping, this may be a bit out of date. But what do we know right now, Jimmy?
Not a whole lot. So, yeah. You know, you had these four University of Idaho students stabbed to death seemingly in their sleep about mid-November, just at a house, a block away from campus. And the police have no suspects. They have not been able to find the murder weapon, which they believe is a large knife. They've been looking for a Hyundai Elantra, I believe, early 2010s model, white, and they've had to sift through a bunch of tips for that. But aside from that, we really don't know a whole lot, which is leading to a lot of, confusion and anxiety in Moscow, to say the least. Kids are trying to figure out whether or not they're going to come back for the spring semester. U of I has promised, more security and, other things that will help students feel comfortable. There's not much you can do when, seemingly there could be someone in Moscow who committed these murders still around and potentially could strike again. We don't know if that's the case, but that's something that people are trying to consider as they make those decisions.
Mm-hmm. So, Kevin, let's talk a little bit about the decisions, because what is the fallout for the University of Idaho as this investigation continues? I mean, we do know that they allowed students to either come back to campus or do remote for until the end of the semester, but school will start again in January.
Right. And we really don't know exactly what that fallout is going to look like and won't until the semester starts on January 11th. We'll start to get a better sense of what happens and what the campus looks like. Jimmy mentioned that, the university has pledged to have more security on campus for spring semester. They did increase security presence on campus after the stabbings. State police particularly had an enhanced presence on campus, but we just really don't know. This happened so late in the fall semester that the university made allowances for students to study at home, to go home early for Thanksgiving break, to finish their semester away from campus if they so chose. It's not clear exactly what that's going to look like. The memo that the university put out to students about a week or so ago indicated that they're hoping students return. They're planning to have classes in person as planned, as the course catalog came out earlier, and kind of left the option that they may move some classes online. They may add some online elements, but it wasn't clear to the extent that they will. Gemma, we'll just have to see what January looks like in terms of this investigation, which has not moved very quickly at all. And mm-hmm. we'll see in terms of what students decide to do when they have the chance to decide whether they want to come back for a semester, when it's a new semester, when students and parents have the option to say, yes, we're comfortable returning to class, or no, we really want to wait and see what's happening up there.
Right. And I'm curious, Kevin, then how that translates for maybe other universities or institutions, right? Do those college students, you know, wait out a semester, or do they maybe enroll somewhere else? But I guess we really don't know any of that until we get into this next, the spring semester.
It will be really interesting to see what those spring enrollment numbers look like, because you always have a drop off from fall to spring for a variety of reasons. You know, students decide to, not come back for spring to some degree. So that's natural. But do we see more of a drop off? And to what extent can you pin any kind of drop off at U of I to the status of this investigation? It's going to be very interesting to see.
Mm-hmm. So I want to go back to June 24th to be exact, when the U.S. Supreme Court overturned Roe versus Wade. Now, this caused quite a ripple effect and lawsuits, in fact, here in Idaho. The Biden administration challenged Idaho's near total abortion ban, and that was just the start of the fallout. So, Melissa and Jimmy, if you guys could jump in, who would like to start by just talking about what happened after this Supreme Court ruling?
Oh, boy. A lot happened. Multiple lawsuits. Yeah. Let's start with the federal government lawsuit, from the Justice Department that came through in July. And ultimately, the Biden administration and the Justice Department really took issue with the part of Idaho's abortion ban that doesn't allow abortions when the woman's health is in jeopardy. It does have exceptions if the woman's life is in jeopardy. But as so many doctors will tell you, there are a lot of pregnancy complications that can result in devastating health, long-term, lifelong health effects for the woman that won't necessarily kill her either. The state argued in federal court that all of that would fall under the existing abortion exemptions in state law, that no prosecutor would be stupid enough to go after a doctor who took care of, say, an ectopic pregnancy. That argument specifically came from the legislature's lawyer that they hired independently from the state attorney general, who was also arguing to keep the abortion ban in place. Ultimately, the judge issued a very narrow ruling that said that emergency rooms that accept federal money do have to perform abortions in the emergency room, or can perform abortions in the emergency room when the woman's health is in grave danger. That was a very narrow abortion ruling. As you mentioned before, we're having this conversation on, earlier than it's taping. And so we don't know yet if the state Supreme Court is going to rule on the three other lawsuits that are hanging out there in state court. And I can let Jimmy talk about those.
Yeah. So, Jimmy, get us updated on that. And again, as Melissa mentioned, we are taping this. So, and we're taping this on December 19th, just to give people some understanding, because Jimmy, something could happen, but from the time we tape this and the time it goes to air.
Yes, absolutely. And it's something that I think all of us on Fridays at, 5:30 are furiously refreshing our browsers to see if, there's any kind of ruling that comes down. Yeah. So those three lawsuits were filed by Planned Parenthood. And they are challenging Idaho's, three separate abortion trigger laws, they sort of regulate the practice to varying degrees, with the 2020 law being the one kind of in force right now, which, as Melissa said, only allows abortions to take place in cases of rape, incest, or when the life of the mother is threatened, though, domestic violence advocates will say that the rape exemption doesn't really mean anything, because you have to file a police report and, the police aren't going to give you that information if an investigation is ongoing. So that's an important consideration. But earlier this year, when Planned Parenthood filed these pretty much immediately after the Supreme Court ruling, took effect or was handed down, and we've just been kind of sitting on our hands waiting to see what happens. The state Supreme Court declined in a 3-2 decision to stay the implementation of these laws, which was, a pretty interesting division within the court, I would say, if you look at how that was decided. And we heard oral arguments, just a couple months ago about whether these laws should be declared unconstitutional. Planned Parenthood says that, this is violating, a patient's right to privacy, to have an abortion, essentially what Roe v. Wade carved out. It's an argument that the state Supreme Court in another decision said, that precedent was thrown out. Roe v. Wade was thrown out. So why should we even consider that? So it's going to be a very interesting decision to come down and see how that is ruled and just how many justices will sign on to the majority opinion.
Mm-hmm. So Jimmy, just to clarify, at this point right now, as of this taping, can a person in Idaho get an abortion?
Not unless it is under one of those, narrow circumstances. As Melissa pointed out, that did widen a little bit with the federal decision to include, mm-hmm. Emergency abortions that threaten the health of the mother.
Okay. Days before this year's Boise Pride Festival was set to kick off, and this was in the summertime, the new chair of Idaho's Republican Party, Dorothy Moon, issued a news release, and it stated that two Pride events, Drag Kids and Drag Queen Story Hour, were encouraging the sexualization of children here in our state. And she called on sponsors to withdraw their support. Now, this tactic, it worked to an extent. After people from all over the country started contacting these organizations, a lot of them withdrew, including Zions Bank, Idaho Power, Idaho Central Credit Union, and CAPED. Others, though, like Blue Cross of Idaho, stayed in place and made a statement on their support. So, Jimmy, let's go back and talk about just how quickly all of this blew up when Dorothy Moon sent out this news release.
Yeah, I think that was the most eye-popping situation, where Dorothy Moon put out this statement saying that, calling on all of these sponsors to withdraw their sponsorship and essentially denounce what she was calling, the sexualization of children. She actually went on a show hosted by Steve Bannon, the embattled former Trump strategist, saying, quote, "We're going to have kids up on stage with exotic dancers and performers and drag queens," which is not true. Exotic dancers were not going to be on stage, according to organizers. But we're talking about less than 24 hours, this turnaround, because I believe that statement came out on a Tuesday or Wednesday before Pride was supposed to, start on a Friday. And, it was just kind of like a cascade, right? Where you had, first it was Zions Bank that pulled out. And then you had, one after the other withdrawing, or at least asking sponsors to just pull their name off of the sponsorship list, even though they were going to continue their financial obligations to them. There were a couple businesses that stood up and tried to take the place of those sponsors. But ultimately, Boise Pride had to, after being defiant, saying there's no way we're going to pull our youth drag show, which was supposed to be on that Sunday, which was September 11th, which was another point of contention with, the GOP and other activists calling for it to be canceled. They said that organizers were like, no, we're not going to pull this. But then they ultimately did cancel that youth drag show, which was disappointing to at least one youth performer that I spoke to.
And Jimmy, I think you're right with just how quickly all of this happened. And then I think the situations that it put organizations in, right? And so I'm curious, though, too, the ramifications then moving forward, not for these organizations that chose to pull their support, or even the organizations that chose to stay, but Boise Pride and what they have then have to deal with since all of this happened.
Mm-hmm. Donald Williamson, who's the chair, I suppose, of Boise Pride, you know, he told me over several conversations, like, you know, this doesn't really change a whole lot. You know, they got roughly about the same amount of money, even though some, you know, financial backers pulled out. So that's not an issue. He was saying that before this all even happened, he was having to turn away sponsors because they just couldn't accommodate them. So it doesn't seem like that would have much of a bearing on the future of Boise Pride. I think what might be, you know, kind of the fallout of this is a heavy consideration as to whether or not they do any kind of youth drag shows in the future. And then, of course, we've heard rumblings, you know, at the legislature, which is coming back in less than a month here, where a bill could be introduced and drafted that would ban public drag shows, you know, if they could be seen by someone who's under 21 or 18 potentially. So that could be, you know, something that would change the actual programming decisions that Boise Pride has to make. But it doesn't seem like they're going to be hurting for money or sponsorship in the future.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So another big story this year, this was the elections. Both the primary and the general elections happened this year, and really a lot of ramifications for the future of our state. So I want to start with the primary. So Clark, were a lot of those races decided during the primary back in May?
Yeah, thanks, Gemma. The primary always holds a lot of weight in Idaho because it's such a one-party state controlled by the Republicans and has been for decades. And so I think looking back to the primary, I think there were something like 19 incumbent Republicans who lost their seats in the primary. And this was an interesting year for a lot of reasons, one of which was because of the redistricting process that took place in 2021. And what that was all about was redrawing Idaho's political boundary lines to accommodate this growth. And it was based on the 2020 census data. So we've got redistricting that put a number of incumbent legislators together in the same district, even though they had been in separate districts previously. So that kind of touched things off. The competitive primary election really, you know, set into motion these changes. But yeah, the primary was a big part of it. That and the frankly, a number of experienced legislators who decided not to run for re-election again in 2022 for one reason or another. Maybe they retired. Maybe they didn't want to run in a new legislative district that they had been drafted into with an incumbent opponent. And so the changes really started with folks not running for re-election and then really ramped up with that May primary election. And it was really competitive on the Republican side. As we talked about before on the show, mm-hmm. the Democrats did not run candidates in the general election for dozens and dozens of legislative seats. And I don't think they really had any competitive primary races, or maybe just a couple of primary races to think of. So this was really affecting the Republicans. And those changes started taking place, like I said, with redistricting and with that primary election in May. And that really set the stage for an interesting November election.
Yeah, to say the least. And then, Melissa, let's talk about the attorney general race, because Lawrence Wasdin, who's the incumbent, and as well as the Idaho Superintendent of Public Instruction, Sherry Ybarra, lost their seats in the general. Can you talk about that? And let's start with the attorney general race, because we knew going into the primary that this would be a tough race.
Absolutely. We knew it would be very competitive. There were three candidates in that primary race, but the real matchup was truly between incumbent Lawrence Wasdin, who had served in that office for 20 years, the longest serving attorney general in Idaho's history, and former U.S. Congressman Raul Labrador. After leaving Congress in 2018, Labrador was active in the Republican Party, served as the chairman, and was very critical of the state's COVID response under Governor Little and Attorney General Wasdin. That, as well as Idaho's involvement or lack thereof in certain lawsuits as it related to the 2020 election, was pretty prominent in Raul Labrador's campaign. Labrador won fairly handily. He won several counties where, you know, Governor Little and Phil McGrain and other, I guess, candidates more closely aligned with Governor Little won. So in other words, there were a lot of people who voted for both Brad Little and, say, Debbie Critchfield, and also chose to vote for Raul Labrador. There's a lot of, you know, the fallout from that several months later, as we're getting ready for the inauguration and for these new constitutional officers to get sworn in. You know, several deputy attorneys general have gone on to find other jobs. They have left the office. When I interviewed Attorney General Wasdin a couple weeks ago, he said that he's not sure if it's more than usual turnover than what we would see in a attorney general administration transitioning from one office to the other. But it is a notable amount of experience that is leaving that office. We do see that when incumbents leave, right? That's not entirely surprising. But I do think that a lot of people were wondering, okay, are they leaving because they really liked Wasdin, or are they leaving because they're not necessarily fans of Labrador? Labrador, for his part, is actively recruiting, other attorneys to serve in that office. He's announced some big hires. I know that he is seeking more. And so, we're going to see how that transition goes in January, February. I think it's a very, very complex state agency. You know, you have deputy attorneys general who work with every single state agency. It's essentially a massive law firm. And so I know that Labrador has been working hard on that upcoming transition, and we'll see how it goes.
And Governor Little kept his seat, Melissa, as we mentioned, as governor, but one of his challengers, Ammon Bundy, got more support than I think a lot of people had expected, but I didn't necessarily find it that surprising that he got the level of support that he did.
You know, neither did I. I know that a lot of people were expecting him to perform much like other independent candidates, right? You know, maybe get 5-7%. You know, he ended up with, I believe, about 17% of the vote in the general election. This wasn't in the primary. Bundy ran as a primary candidate. But he did pull a lot of support from people who had previously supported Janice McGeehan, who challenged Brad Little in the primary election. So you can look at Bundy's performance in a couple ways. You can say, man, Bundy spent hundreds of thousands of dollars, I think by the end of it, about $700,000 to get 17% of the vote. I know that there were opponents of Bundy who were like, that's kind of embarrassing. You can also look at it as, this is a movement among conservatives that has growing momentum. You know, you can see that with support, the support that Janice McGeehan had. Ultimately, she obviously didn't win the primary. And I think she underperformed by a lot, but the people who supported her vociferously. And it's the same with Bundy. There were no lukewarm Bundy supporters. You were 100% for Bundy if you voted for him, right? Mm-hmm. And we're seeing that influence have other ripple effects throughout the party too. We're going to see that with the GOP's winter meeting right before the legislative session. There are a lot of proposals that we also saw you know, similar ones during their big summer convention that really show this tightening of ranks, right? That like, this is the new Republican Party. We are incredibly conservative. These are the things we stand for, and we are not going to tolerate any sort of deviation from this platform that we have put out. And so what my takeaway from the primary and the general election this year, it wasn't just about the results. Obviously, Brad Little had widespread support among the general population in Idaho. He did very, very well in both the primary and the general. But the people who are very involved with the party, a lot of them supported McGeehan, a lot of them supported Bundy. And those are the ramifications, you know, and how that plays out in upcoming legislative sessions and elections mm-hmm. that I'm going to be looking for.
Jimmy, is it fair to say that the Idaho legislature will look drastically different in a couple of weeks?
Oh, easily. Yeah. I mean, we have almost half of the 105 legislative seats turning over in some capacity, whether that was through retirement, incumbents getting beaten in the primary, or, you know, swapping seats over from the House to the Senate. And not only are there going to be, dozens of new faces, but you also have these new faces generally being more conservative, especially in the Senate. JFAC, the Joint Finance and Appropriations Committee, which, writes Idaho's budget, has, several new members, not to mention that in the House, Democrats lost a seat thanks to new House Speaker Mike Moyle kind of reshuffling that. So, I mean, mm-hmm. it's going to be an astounding new year, and people are trying to get their feet under them. Anyone who has to work with the legislature, I'm thinking lobbyists and state agencies who might have, had these good or potentially bad relationships with former lawmakers, and now they get a chance to make new relationships.
And Clark, what will you be paying the most attention to with this upcoming session and how different it will potentially be looking?
Well, I think there's so many new people in so many new positions, like Jimmy had talked about, that I'm really going to be interested in seeing who carves out what role for themselves, whether that's on JFAC, the budget committee that Jimmy mentioned, whether that's the whole new slate of House Republican leadership, starting with new Speaker of the House, Mike Moyle, and going on down the list with a whole new slate of Republican leadership officials, to the Idaho Senate, like Jimmy mentioned, who the Idaho Senate for the last 12 years that I've been covering the Idaho legislature had historically been sort of a check on the more conservative Idaho House. We saw this a lot over the last 2 years, where the Idaho Senate would refuse to hear or vote on some of the more extreme legislation that passed the Idaho House. A lot of that died in the Senate because it never got a hearing. And so between some conservative members of the House moving over to the Idaho Senate this year, coupled with brand new conservative senators, some far right extreme conservative senators that are going to be taking office, I think that there's a lot to watch in terms of who's going to have influence, who's going to fill what niche, who's going to carve out roles for themselves. And then we can get into the policy discussions and how that will play out. We still need the legislature to decide how it will implement more than $300 million of public school funding that was approved during the September 1 special session. We expect movement on bills relating to abortion in the kind of post-Roe v. Wade landscape that we have. As Kevin well knows, there may be a lot of discussions about changing the education funding formula or the education funding delivery model. Kevin had a really good article at Idaho Education News within the last couple of weeks about this debate, about vouchers, about education savings accounts, and the difference between those two ideas and how that could affect things going forward. So, but yeah, like Jimmy talked about, we've got 39 first-time legislators who are going to be taking their seats when the session opens January 9th. And when you look at people going between one chamber and the other, people who've been out of office and were elected back into office. Now we are looking at 51 people out of 105 legislators who will be in new roles next year. Mm. There's a ton of new committee chair positions that have changed, from the Senate Education Committee to both JFAC chairs, to the House Revenue and Tax Committee, to the House Health and Welfare Committee, I believe Senate Health and Welfare Committee. So many new changes. It's really going to be difficult to predict exactly what's going to happen. But I'm going to be interested in how these new legislators stake out their turf, and then the policy positions that flow from there. And it's also worth noting that Republicans did pick up a seat in the legislature, and Idaho voters approved a constitutional amendment that will allow the Idaho legislature to call itself back into session without the governor's authority for pretty much any reason that they can agree on. And the Republicans have such a large supermajority that Republicans could make that move without any Democratic support. And so I actually think that the Idaho legislature is probably the most powerful that I've seen it in the last 12, 13 years that I've been covering the Idaho legislature. So I think there's a lot to watch, but I'd love to hear what Melissa or Kevin have to say as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, Gemma, to Clark's point about the interplay between the Senate and the House, I'm always interested in the education committees, but I think this year, even people who don't cover education for a living are going to be interested in these two committees, because Senate education is going to be much more conservative than we've seen in the past. It's pretty clear that there's a cadre of hardline conservatives on that committee who I think are going to be very friendly to any kind of school choice legislation. And I'm going to be really curious to see how they respond to and how they interact with education stakeholder groups, education lobby groups. This may be one time, though, where things kind of reverse, where the House may be a moderating influence against the Senate, because I think the House Education Committee, a little bit harder to handicap, but for sure, Julie Yamamoto, the new chair of that committee, Lori McCann, the new vice chair of that committee, have proven themselves in their first terms to be pretty moderate and fairly skeptical of some of the school choice proposals that have come down the pike. So it will be really interesting to see how those two committees play out, because, again, as Clark mentioned, there's a lot of money on the line in terms of education mm-hmm. funding that we still have to figure out where it's going to go and how it's going to be spent.
So, Kevin, talk about go ahead, Melissa. Sorry.
Just real quick, I want to add that, you know, the four reporters on this panel right now, with the recent retirements that we have seen in the Idaho Press Corps, this is a terrifying thought, but the four of us will have been the longest serving reporters in the Idaho Capitol Press Corps next year. And I think that we, along with a lot of the lobbyists, along with a lot of the staff, are going to have to throw out our preconceptions about how the legislature works. You know, like Jimmy and Clark and Kevin all said, for years and years, we've said, okay, you know, the Senate is the place where a lot of these bills go to die because they won't get hearings. Mm-hmm. And you know, this is the way the House has operated for years. And this is the way the Senate has operated for years. And that's not going to be the case anymore. And I think that we're really going to have to be on our game, relearning these new dynamics as they're shaking out.
Yeah, I think that's such a good point, Melissa. It is going to be, you know, it's going to look so different on how all of this plays out this year. So, Kevin, I want to talk a little bit about Reclaim Idaho's initiative. This was big news all year. That is, until lawmakers gutted it with an infusion of cash to the education budget. Can you get us updated on that?
Right. So basically, Reclaim Idaho, the folks who brought the Medicaid expansion initiative in 2018, got an initiative on the ballot that would have increased income taxes and corporate tax rates to pay for about $330 million a year in K-12 spending. That got on the ballot, but pretty soon after it got on the ballot, Governor Little convened a special session of the legislature. We've kind of alluded to it here already. And in that one-day special session, the legislature agreed to put $330 million of annual funding into education, into K-12. Annual funding that will come mostly from sales taxes, not from any increases in the income tax rates. They also created this $80 million fund to address in-demand careers to help Idahoans prepare for high-demand jobs. We don't know how any of that money is going to be spent, but clearly the reason that we're talking about this money is because Reclaim Idaho got this initiative on the ballot. So, you know, the origins of what we saw in September really came from what transpired in the months leading up to September, the months that Reclaim Idaho went out and gathered signatures to get an education funding initiative on the ballot. Now, that initiative was pulled after the special session, so Idahoans didn't vote on the initiative. They didn't have the chance to vote on the initiative.
So as you mentioned, this special session, and we should note that Idaho is also currently sitting on a surplus of more than $1.5 billion. That's with a B, billion. Really, the state's been swimming in this extra money. And Clark, that surplus meant that we saw tax rebates, we saw a change in income taxes. But what else should we be looking at? Because, you know, this surplus is going to keep making news and making waves, frankly, into the new year.
Yeah, and we're actually talking about 3 years in a row at this point of gigantic surpluses in excess of $1 billion. When we talked about the special session with the tax rebate and the education funding, that actually came from the previous year's budget surplus. Idaho runs on a fiscal year calendar. It can be a little confusing, but it's basically July 1 to June 30th every year. So Idaho's budget year or fiscal year is on a different calendar than the traditional monthly calendar. And so that's just one thing to think about. But, you know, fast forward past the special session, past last year's surplus, we're again halfway into this new 2023 fiscal year, looking at another, as you said, $1.54 billion with a B surplus that legislators are going to have projected on their hands when the session begins in a couple of weeks on January 9th. I did a story, and Betsy Russell of the Idaho Press did a story about some of the growing momentum to maybe look at using some of that surplus or having some kind of a tax shift to reduce property taxes. We've seen income tax bills over the last couple of years that passed. But two things the legislature hasn't addressed, the sales tax on groceries, the so-called grocery tax, and then the property tax. And so we have a couple of high-ranking Republican officials in important places, including Representative Wendy Horman, the House co-chair of the JFAC Budget Committee, and Senator Scott Groh, the Senate co-chair of JFAC, both coming out in recent weeks saying they think we need to take a hard look at directing some of this surplus or doing some kind of a shift to address property taxes. That's something that the legislature and Idaho Governor Brad Little were not able to do over the last 4 years. We've heard a lot of talk about this in the past, but it does seem like there's some money available and some influential legislators really leading into the session, promoting this and saying that we need to hear these bills. We can't hold them in a chairman's drawer and not hold a hearing on them. We owe it to Idahoans to have hearings on these bills, to bring them forward and to vote on them. So that could be one thing that could be potentially really, really interesting in terms of the personal property tax and whether or how the Idaho legislature can address it this year. And that's just one idea. And I know that there will be a lot of competition. Kevin's done a lot of great reporting over the years about how when there are surpluses or times when money is available, that can really lead to controversial legislative sessions and debates. And so there will be a lot of ideas for using that money. There will also be a lot of, you know, given the conservative nature of the legislature and the GOP supermajority, there will be calls to hold off on spending that money as well. So I think it'll be really interesting, but I do expect we'll have a fight on our hands about money once we get into things, into the thick of it in the new year.
Yeah, I think it's going to be a wild ride in the legislative session come 2023. I just have a couple of minutes left, and I want to try to get to two more things, one being politics and education. Kevin, we are seeing this more and more in Idaho and how polarizing it is. I mean, even on the smallest level. So can you, you know, talk a little bit about how politics really seems to have leaked into what used to be these kind of sleepy school trustee races?
Yeah, I can't possibly recap what's happening at North Idaho College in a couple of minutes, except to say that it's crazy. There's a lot of turnover and turmoil right now, and it kind of goes back to trustee elections that we've had at North Idaho College in 2020 and in 2022, a very divided board of trustees with questions right now about who's going to be the president of this college in the short term and or the long term, questions about accreditation. You also had, closer to home here, you had a series of trustee races for a College of Western Idaho. And you had quite a bit of money brought into that campaign at the very end from folks who wanted to stay the course at CWI. They wanted the incumbents back in office. They didn't want a slate of candidates who were really running more of a hardline opposition campaign, talking about anything from CWI's participation in Boise Pride, which we talked about earlier. CWI was not participating in Boise Pride. A student club was participating in Boise Pride. Candidates really talking about those kind of hot button issues. I think education politics has become a lot more strident than we've seen in past years. College trustee elections, community college trustee elections were, you know, really kind of an afterthought there. They appear at the end of the ballot. Not a lot of money in those races, not a lot of campaigning in those races. I think that's changing. And I think we're seeing a change also with school boards. We had some pretty heated school board elections in Boise in September. And one of the big changes, one of the big things that happened in that election, Shiva Rajamandari, a Boise High School senior, won a race defeating an incumbent. And part of the backlash against that incumbent was, you know, his receiving an endorsement from the Idaho Liberty Dogs. He disavowed the endorsement. He didn't disavow it as quickly and as forcefully as maybe people were hoping that he would. I mean, the Liberty Dogs have been a pretty strident, vocal group about, you know, libraries and library content. So anyway, long story short, you've got a lot of changes going on in the way people look at education politics. And it's starting to embody itself in races that we normally didn't pay a lot of attention to.
Well, I appreciate all four of you and the work that you do. And I hope you have a good holiday season. Rest up for what could very well be a wild and interesting legislative session. So my appreciation to all four of you. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Gemma.
As always, we want to thank all of our reporters who really make our Friday Reporter Roundtable such a success. We have really incredible journalists in our state, and we are lucky to be able to bring them onto our program every Friday. So to all of our reporters, even if you weren't on the program today, a huge thank you to all of you. And a thank you to Melissa Davlin, host of Idaho Reports on Idaho Public Television, Clark Corbin with the Idaho Capital Sun, our very own James Dawson with Boise State Public Radio News, and Kevin Richards, senior reporter and blogger with Idaho Education News. I hope everyone has a wonderful new year. Maybe we tiptoe into 2023. But again, thank you to all of you. Thanks so much for listening to Idaho Matters. Boise State Public Radio and Idaho Matters are members of the NPR Network. It's an independent coalition of public media podcasters. You can find more shows in the network wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Gemma Gaudette. We'll see you tomorrow.
Experiencing the news each day can feel like a journey. With Up First from NPR, it doesn't have to be. Welcome to 15 easy minutes of breaking news, clarity on international and national affairs, all handed over not from some floating voice in the sky, from us, Layla, A, Steve, and me, Rachel. Start your day informed. Subscribe to Up First wherever you get your podcasts.